As you make your way in, we're going to be, I'm going to try and keep this, I know about this time, day and a half through, you've been listening to people talk for an hour at a time. It's like going to 50 church services in a row without the fun part, the singing. If you can move forward, we're going to do some stuff that'll help if we're compressed a little bit more. I don't want to be having to run all over the place. And there's lots of seats up here. I'm going to just start here while everybody's getting moved in with a mea culpa. How many of you were at my my presentation on Wednesday at the pre-conference? Okay, well, you came back. That's good. But, you know, I knew that I would be stretching it to move into classical history. For those who were there, I tried to start out with an attention-getting mechanism that I thought, what could I use to get headmasters of classical Christian schools interested? And, you know, you're not a regular lot. Most people wouldn't find the Punic Wars that engaging, but I figured, okay, I'll go for the Punic Wars. Now, my wife tells me all the time to stick to what I know, and I violated that rule. I, as most of you know, have a business background, and in my thought, I had been reviewing a class not some months ago. It was a Greek class, and the Greek teacher told a story of a battle between Hannibal and Scipio. And I thought, okay, I can check the facts real quick on Wiki and come in, and I think I can tell that story. And of course, I got it wrong. I called Hannibal a Greek. It's not a Greek. I had good reasons, honest I did, but I got no end of it. You know it's bad when you're at a conference and you give a business talk and the guy who wrote the book on the subject is in the room. I have to publicly thank Ben House for giving me a book complete. Now, my edition is extra special. It has an added map in the beginning. And he's pointing out that Hannibal, of course, was a Carthaginian. Therefore, there were no elephants in Greece. He drew some pictures. He's a better author than illustrator, but somehow I'm going to try and stick to what I know today. The way this is going to go, I gave this talk a couple of years ago. Were any of you at this one a couple of years ago? Okay, good. A couple of you were. Here's the real mea culpa in this whole thing. I was asked to speak on this again. I don't know why, but I do know that this is as big of a challenge, and we struggle with this as much or more than most schools. We're in Boise, Idaho. Boise, Idaho is, I think I told you the last time I told the story of it being Quittersville. It was about three-quarters of the way through the Oregon Trail, and the Oregon Trail passes right through the city, just a few miles south of my house. And Boise is French for the city of trees. If you ever come there, you'll be sorely disappointed. We have a few cottonwoods scraggling their way and struggling a living out along the Boise River. And the pioneers, as they would crest the rise on the edge of town, would see these scraggly cottonwoods and say, "Look, trees." So that's where it got its name, because they'd just come across 200 miles of barren desert. And so it's Quittersville because all the people who just, you know, they've been told of the promised land out further in the Willamette Valley of Oregon, lush farmland, they get there and they go, well, some portion of them stopped and made a town and said, this will have to do. And so we live in a culture in our town of this will have to do. It's a bit of the way that the city has risen up. And of course, classical Christian education isn't at that compatible with that mentality. So before I get started here too much, I'll just say that we struggle with this issue as much as you do. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to talk for about 20 minutes. This is new. If I can get through it in 20 minutes, I'm going to invite a new employee of our school up, Davies Owens, who has been a headmaster of a school in Atlanta, and he'll give his perspective on it for a few minutes. That's what happens if you become a new employee at our school. I give you jobs the day of, and so he's going to hop in and do that, and then we're going to do a little roundtable with you all and see if you have some ideas that have worked in your school, and there'll be some ground rules for that to keep it from getting long, but we'll come back to that in a few moments. Right now I'm going to talk about kind of our school, and like I said, I'm going to start with a story of three of our graduates this year. All three of them National Merit Scholars. We graduated 15 students, and we had three National Merit Scholars in our school. All three of them have been at our school since early grammar school or kindergarten, so they've been there a very long time. We've had them in our classrooms a very, very many hours. I don't know how to count it. We actually put them, I think two of the three, or maybe all three, were sitting in a kind of a round table I did with students earlier this year, filming a promotional for our school, asking them what they liked about, or what was worthwhile about classical Christian education for them. And they were extremely eloquent about it. They understood it, in some cases, better than I do. And all three of their parents have been in to see me in the last year with problems because they don't understand what we're doing. And one of them was upset because we were reading Homer, and he didn't see any purpose in reading anything but the Bible. Another one was concerned that we didn't have enough AP classes. And a third was concerned that they had a younger son in the school, that things were just too difficult at our school. So, and in fact, in this case, we're quite familiar with his son, and he doesn't like to work very much. But regardless of the truth of the matter, the point I wanted to make is I will do my best to tell you what we do to try and educate parents, but it's evident that the three top academic students in our school this year, they get it, their parents don't, and so I'm obviously not doing a great job of this, but we will hopefully be able to share our collective resources here. So building parent support. Step away with the mic here. One of the problems you have with retention in a classical Christian school is that people's needs change, and it is typically because their kids change. Now, parents, we have to be pretty empathetic to understand parents rarely see this. They don't think their kids are changing, but their kids change and their needs change. So early on, the K-6ers, you've seen them come in the door, they love to see the Christian influence, you know, the loving Christian teachers. That's a big factor for them. The bullying, having nice structure, they like the fact that their kids are going to be safe. The small class sizes, it's real intimate and better academics. And then you get into 9 through 12. Christian influence is still important to most Christian parents in these grades, but influence is different for this group. What they really mean by Christian influence is their peers more than they do their teachers. They do have some interest in Christian teachers, but many of them start to be concerned more with, my kid can handle it. Distractions, obviously, one reason parents choose Christian schools is the dress, the music, and the culture. The educational options and specialization, and this is a big one, right? I mean, how many charter schools are popping up that do everything from math and science to agriculture to you name it, I suppose, women's studies. There's probably everything out there in a charter school these days. Better academics is also a factor. But the issue becomes that parents are more concerned with what their kids are experiencing and what they want in these older ages than they are when they're younger. So this is kind of the air we breathe trying to keep parents with us. So I'll These are our attrition rates. And one thing I would like to say is there are some parents you are never going to convince. There are some parents you're just not going to convince. Right now, we have between K and 4, we have about 45 kids. That's our max. We're full. We have waiting lists. But starting around 4th grade, you see the attrition start down. We have 44 students in the 4th, 36 in the 6th, 34 in the 8th, 25 in the 10th, and 21 in the 12th. Some of that is because our earlier classes were smaller, but that's not all of it. That 10th grade class was probably about 35 kids 4 years ago. And so it's dropped to 25. So when I've done our forecasts and our business planning for the school, I've got two choices. We either have to recruit heavily in the deep secondary, or we just have to plan for smaller classes. So we designed the school to have 25 graduates. That's its maximum amount. Because otherwise you end up, you know, you just got to account on attrition. We're in a cultural war, and there are casualties, and they will probably leave your school. So, with that, what should we do? Finding ways of increasing the perceived value. I've talked about this before in my seminars. Really, sometimes parents will come in to me and say, I can't afford the school. And once in a while, that's true, but most often, the problem is one of value, not one of affording the school. If they perceive that the value they're getting from your school is high, they will sacrifice other things to be at your school. So the trick to retention and the trick to getting is getting parent buy-in at a level that they will pay the tuition gladly because they think it's a bargain. Okay? And I have a lot of those parents at the school. I kind of told, you know, a rough story, but I got a lot of parents who are always saying we're too cheap, right? And that's nice of them to say, but in fact, the job we have, the purpose of this presentation, is to get that perceived value up among families. So I often talk about the fact that you need to know what you're going to say before you have to say it. You've got to have kind of an elevator pitch that you go through with parents. And so you need to work that up and have your mission clearly spelled out, especially in terms that they can understand. Talk a little bit about first impressions. Our school spends energy. You see here on the upper left, this is one of our upper school classrooms. We use tables in there. These big oak tables were a couple, $2,000-$3,000 a piece, but they're one of our best parent retention tools because parents look at them and go, why do you have those in there in the secondary? And I get to tell the whole story of because it's an engaging education. It's not an education where we bawl words into their ears. It's an education where they engage us, we engage them, and we train them in thinking. So we also, we do some things regarding, this is one of the collages we do with extracurricular activities. I really want to move through some of this stuff and get into, this is marketing stuff that I think I covered in that first session. So I'm just going to hit some real practical things we do. I kind of abbreviated this because I think we've got some opportunity here to engage all of you in this discussion. These are just some things I do. It's supposed to be once a week, but at some times of the year it ends up more like once a month. I send an email blast out to all of our parents. I'm sure many of you do that. It helps connect them with me. I'm sitting in a back office. They don't often see me or know who I am. So I just send it out, and I include a little classical philosophy. But here's the issue. If you do it the way all of us are tempted to do, pontificating on some point that we read in a work earlier in the week by Augustine, we're probably not going to keep their attention. Will probably be on the junk mail list of their email as quick as you can spit. So what I do, these email about weekly, I always start with a personal story. My kids were doing this. I was in so-and-so's class, and I saw that. I was driving down the road, and I saw this. They want to know who you are. You're, after all, running the school where their kids are. And it's great. You know, they want to know something about you personally. But I usually only take one or two sentences to make that point, and then I move into some cultural intersection between classical education and the culture. And it's really easy to do that. You can run into it every day. You can comment on Homer Simpson, or you can comment on, you know, the Hunger Games, and you've got them right away. You've got them quickly. And then I always conclude, I try and keep it to one paragraph, sometimes two paragraphs. In the email, you have to be able to see the end when you open it. That's my philosophy. If you don't get, if it's just all text, I delete it. So if any of you ever email me, that's the secret to me reading it. I've got to be able to see the end when I open it. So they're short, and I do a bulleted point of what's gone on at the school, what I've been working on at the school the last 3 or 4 weeks. Because a lot of times they don't know how hard you all work. They don't know that you went to a conference this past week and you listened to Doug Wilson and George Grant and others and tell them what you learned. But I just do it in 1, 2, 3 bullet points. Each one is just 2 sentences. So these are the headmaster's notes. These are pretty popular. I get a lot of comments on these. And I think a lot of people do actually read these. We have a parent library in our front office where you can barely pass the field trip sign-in basket and the lost and found without running into our parent library. It's right there for them to see, and it's got all the books in it. We just charge whatever we get the books for to get them to buy them. So I encourage you to try that. This is one that's been very popular. It's called Nightstand Articles. So at the beginning of every year, I do a session with all of our parents. It's a back-to-school section, and we give this out. It's a paper-bound, thin set of articles. I tell them, I know it's hard to read everything that people give you, so just put this on your nightstand, and you can read each one of these in 1 or 2 sittings. They're about 2 pages each. And they contained various pieces on classical Christian education. And here's the first 2 pages of it. It's an annotated bibliography. So what I'm doing, if you see this, is I'm explaining why each of these articles is relevant to them, why they want it, why they want to read it. And that's what these annotations are. So the first one there is an essay called Iron Sharpening Iron. But by the way, people have asked me for this. I don't distribute this because for copyright reasons, we can only distribute it in an educational context. So that's why I do it in a back-to-school night training seminar, is it's part of that. And so you can go out and find these articles, ones like them, and do the same thing yourself. Iron Sharpening Iron is on the Socratic Method. It's by a guy by the name of Jeff Baldwin. It's a great piece. It was put on my desk a long time ago by a teacher. The War of the Great Books just happens to talk about the great books. The Long War Between Materialism and Christianity by Nancy Piercy. Screwtape proposes a toast. This is a great one. These are, by the way, ordered in order of, you know, heaviness, how hard they are to read. And so that goes on a little bit. We got a second sheet there. We do some discipleship. I find 5 to about 12 men that I get together with regularly and try and answer their questions. It's more of a Bible study kind of thing, but it's informal, and I just answer their questions, because the neat thing about classical Christian education is it's a pretty broad thing, so you can usually cover anything from it. So with that, I'm going to turn the time a few minutes over to Davies to talk about things that he's found successful at his school. Davies presents on this topic occasionally, and then what I'm going to do after that is we're going to come around and see if any of you have suggestions or things that work in your school. We're going to put some boundaries on it. About 30 seconds is all we're going to have per person as we walk around, and try and keep it to concrete, specific things that you do to build that parent, to build up parent buy-in to what you're doing. So, Davies, if you want to come up.
Thanks, David. All right. Well, it's good to be here, and it's good to be a part of David's team. It's quite a contrast going into the world of Boise and the world of Two or Three Trees from Atlanta, Georgia. I've been a part of Heritage Preparatory School, a K through 8 in Atlanta, one of about 65 private schools just inside the Perimeter Highway, a very competitive environment as a classical Christian school. And so lots of parents that are constantly reevaluating the school and reevaluating their decision. And so parent education, I'm convinced, is the most important issue in terms of just maintaining health for the school. And I always said if I ever had a $50 million endowment, one of the first things I would do would be to hire a full-time director of parent education and build a building next door that they could just be educating parents constantly. The corporate world says that every 30 days you have to repeat a vision or it's quickly forgotten. And it's so true in the school world. We all know that cycle in August. You've got everybody cheering you on. This is the greatest decision anyone's made. And within about 30 days, they're all off grumbling and quickly forgetting what's going on. I think one of the biggest challenges, and I'll get real quickly, I don't have a lot of time, to just some of the best practices that we have found. It's against the philosophical backdrop of we've got to understand where people are today in the culture. And people today, us included, are completely overwhelmed with information. And to David's point, we go into the back room and we've read this incredible piece on Aristotle and we're ready to tell the world how great it is. And they could absolutely care less. I had a very humbling moment early on where Heritage would produce this weekly Monday memo piece, and there was always this special piece from the head of school, and we did it in paper for years, and then we finally went electronic using one of those constant contact type delivery systems, which would show you the actual page views and numbers of actual openings on the part of the recipients. And I was very humbled to discover only about 61% of the parents actually even opened the newsletter, and even fewer bothered to make any kind of engagement. There was always the two faithful moms that read everything and loved whatever I said, but everyone else was kind of off in their own world. And I think some of that is simply because of the information overload. So we have to be very strategic in what we communicate and how and when we do so. And just real quickly, I want to mention, Robert Wilson did this comment or this research on the doubling of information in our culture and the doubling of at an exponential rate. He says if we start with 1 AD, it breaks down to the information in our world doubled once between Christ and Leonardo da Vinci, once between Da Vinci and the American Revolution, once between the Revolution and the early 1900s, and then once again in the 1950s, again in 1960, 1967, and 73, and then in the first 10 years of the 21st century, it began to double, that is, information every 18 months, and it is now expected that by the end of 2012, information in the entire globe will double every day, and by the end of this year, every second. So you're talking about we're just fried with information, and so when we start pushing information out to parents, we've got to understand we are one of many voices out there. So a couple of things that we did that I think have one of many attempts to bring a solution to parent communication education is, first of all, recognizing the value of peer influence, that parents, like all of us, make very few buying decisions without first checking with what everybody else has to say about it. So we go to Amazon, we read the reviews. In the school business, you can talk all you want to, but it's what the parents are saying to each other in the parking lot that's really making the big decision. So how do we leverage the peer influence among parents? At Heritage, we took what was mother's prayer and father's prayer, and we dialed it up a notch. Mother's prayer became face-to-face, and so it was a monthly in-home gathering with the mothers all getting together, bringing in a key speaker to speak to issues that were relevant to mothers, and then it always tied back into the value propositions that they were getting through the school, through classical education. Mentoring is something I've seen done through a number of schools. The school that Heritage is based on is here in Dallas called the Providence School. We were just visiting there earlier this week, and one of the things they discovered was that many of the values for classical education that were kind of assumed or valued in the culture 25 years ago when they began had sort of been abandoned by the younger sets of parents coming in. So they went and found the mothers and fathers whose children had graduated 20 years ago and brought them in and formulated a peer or a mentoring program for the older moms to come put an arm around a younger mom and say, hey, listen, don't stress out. They don't have to have a private soccer coach when they're 3 years old. They will make it through life. Let me talk about why this school is a valuable school. So that peer influence, the mentoring influence, if you can figure out ways of leveraging that, I think it's very effective. We also did a strategy of in-home coffees. So we would ask families to simply open up a home, pick a topic that was relevant to their peers, so that if they were in middle school and they're finding technology to be an overwhelming situation in their own homes, they would email out a group of moms or dads, and you'd have a dozen or 20 people show up in a home, have coffee and cake, and then we'd sit around and have a conversation looking at the influence of technology in this of this topic, and then tying it back into how classical education addresses some of those challenges. So again, getting where they are with content that's real and relevant for them at that moment. In the business world or in the assembly world, car assembly has for years figured out the importance of JIT productivity, just in time. So in other words, when they're coming down the assembly line, they don't need the seats of the car to arrive 2 days before the car frame gets to that point on the assembly line. And I think, again, as schools, how can we get the information to the parent at the point at which they need that information? So again, David's only giving me a few minutes on all this, but there's so much content that we produce as a school that goes in a newsletter that then is buried on a back shelf that would be very helpful to that parent at a moment in time that they're actually going through that issue. To David's point, a kindergartner's got a completely different set of needs and issues than a middle school parent. So are there ways to digitize that information, to distribute it out to them and create a portal, a media portal where that information is warehoused? Let me move through a couple other things. On that note, we discovered that the creation of little mini white papers would be a helpful resource. So, for instance, topics like why do you wear uniforms as a classical school for boys? Why do you teach Latin? These are kind of, you know, at some point these questions are going to keep coming up again and again and again. So going and extracting information that maybe was in a newsletter several years ago, bringing it and putting it in a common format, little cards of no more than about 400 words that can be put in the front office and kind of on a cascading display board where you can just pull out a card on a various topic, and then taking that same content and reframing it in an electronic format on the school website for prospective parents. So it's just these basic questions keep coming back up, and questions that may not have been, again, relevant to a kindergartner or become relevant later on. In the admissions process, I think we can't say enough about looking at what you're doing in that pre-decision time frame to communicate the why to parents. I was in the church world for years. I did lots of premarital counseling, and I discovered you could have a couple, you'd ask a couple to come to about 10 sessions of premarital counseling, and they would gladly do so, but the day they get married, they will not come back unless they're on the edge of divorce. And I think with parents, they will do anything you ask on the front end prior to their child being accepted and going through that first year, and then it becomes very difficult to get them to come back. So my point is, through the admissions process, what are you doing to inculcate in the parents the who, what, when, where, and how, and why of the school? So we would spend at Heritage at least an hour with each parent as part of the admissions process, a ton of effort to do that interview. But we wanted to make sure before we got married that we were all on the same page. Same thing with prior to the start of the school year, a new parent orientation, an evening, very tactical, very specific. Here's why we, you know, don't do pop culture this way. This is why we read the great books. These are the very specific things that were being presented not only by us as a school, but also by, we also had host families that would then mentor and walk alongside those families. Again, moving very quickly here. Couple more things, and then we'll open it up to everybody else. We found the value of workshops, and we discovered at 1:30 on Thursday afternoons was a prime time for parent workshops because, you know, this was an hour before carpool. Parents could arrive an hour earlier. We'd pick a workshop on a range of topics. It was everything from the kindergarten parents a month into school, we realized were really interested in how do I read to my child better at home. That was sort of a theoretical issue until the first month of school, or how do I help my child with homework, or let's help the rising fourth and fifth grade parents really start thinking seriously about recommitting for middle school. So we would bring these tight 1 hour workshops, very specific topics together during the school day, and we found that parents would routinely come and appreciate the content that was being offered up. And then just last practical thing we've done by way of parent education was we recognize that, you know, the fathers, I think we fathers, and I'm one, I've got three children, we tend to think sometimes that the school world, the school domain is kind of our wives, and we're out, you know, bringing home the bacon or whatever it may be. And so we got very intentional. We decided that we would have the slogan, you know, no father left behind. We all the children, okay, but no dads left behind. So we formed a task force of men, of a new generation coming up, and just said, we have got to get your engagement and understanding why the classical Christian approach is important, getting the dads involved. So that became practical, and that they were there for dad Saturday work days, helping to lead golf tournaments. But it was dad on dads, down to the detailed point of actually dividing them up into threesomes and asking these fathers to get together at some point during the course of the year, a couple different times, just have lunch together, and to reinforce the decision for why they had chosen our school with one another. I think if dads can buy into it, you've got a lot of advantage there. I could go on. Let me hit pause and open it up. David, you want to ask? All right.
I was just going to hop up. Do you want to?
No, go ahead.
Just start.
Yeah.
Turn. Okay, so what we're going to do, you can ask questions if you want, but if you want to just express something you do at your school that has worked, maybe something that hasn't worked, but we'd prefer to hear about things we could actually use, so we'll talk about working. And so I'll let Davies go around. I want to reinforce what he just said. That's a great point about dads. Of that story I told you earlier with the three students, all three of the parents who didn't get it were dads. Two of the three moms got it and came to me desperately, because they had younger kids they were afraid were going to get pulled out of school, desperately wanting me to talk to these dads to get them turned around. So what Davies said is key. It seems like the moms are the ones often who are driving, you know, the school things, but it's dad who ultimately, in almost all these cases, ends up pulling the kids out. So I think that is a very good point to be made. So who we have a comment over here. So remember the ground rules here, 30 seconds, no more than 30 seconds, and you can ask questions. We can try and shoot that.
Quick question, and you've both of you to some extent have addressed this. What have you found to be the least effective and perhaps even counterproductive things that you've done?
Speeches. I mean, speeches in parent meetings, you know, calling everybody in on a Thursday night and giving an hour-long speech about classical education is the least productive in my experience.
No, I think that's,
do you have an answer?
No, yeah. I think that's, I would agree, just things that tend to be more, again, if it's more peer on peer where they can get together and talk about it and commiserate and encourage, it's helpful, yeah.
Probably the second least are some of the books. Doug's books usually do okay, but you know, if you get into heavy, I recommended The Great Tradition. I think it's one of the best books in the world, but for most parents, it's way over their heads.
That actually partially addresses my question. You have written on your outline establishing a reading program for parents. We haven't had a lot of success with that, so I wondered how you did it that was successful.
Well, I'll answer first, and then I'd like Davies to comment on that. But one of the things is you got to realize that you've got, not all parents are monolithic. You've kind of got this broad segment out there. And I would say about 15% of my parents are engaged readers. They learn by reading. And that's who buys the books in our front office library. And that's the reading program that we have out there. And so you can't, just because only 15% are reading the books, doesn't mean you shouldn't provide the books. We provide the books because those 15% can become our greatest advocates.
I was going to say, building on the idea of the nightstand readings, we put together an anthology of just excerpts, and so we would do coffee and conversations, I think kind of hand-holding the reading a bit for those who are not active readers, and just say, here's a 3 to 5 page pre-read, come together and let's have coffee and conversation. Again, you can do that during the school day or in the evening. That helped, I think, bring people in that normally would just run after and grab a book. Ted?
I worked for the last 5 years in a rural setting, right on the edge of suburbia, so context important. I was looking hard for the last couple of years at getting the Christians to notice us, because we did lots of stuff to market to everybody and anybody. And so spending probably the first year getting to know pastors. And then the next year we did a Bring Your Pastor to School Day. And I mean, I think 10 years ago I might have done that, and I thought, oh, this is kind of hokey. But last year, the kids were so excited in bringing their pastor to school. The leverage was great. Who's going to turn down the child asking the pastor to come to school? We did a little speech. We put our students in front of the, did some dog and pony show kind of thing, Shirley Grammar, Latin jingles, all that kind of stuff. Had our seniors up there so they could ask our upperclassmen questions about what they're studying, what they like, just get real personal with them, and then had lunch together. And what we saw was Facebook pictures nonstop. You know, is their moms and dads putting it up, or with their pastor? The pastor's putting it up, I'm with the kids. And it just seemed like win-win all the way around, just getting the word out in the Christian community.
All right, thank you. I wanted to, Davies mentioned the cards. We do this at our school. I can get my connector back in. This is one of them I wanted to bring up. We have a cascading, there's 10 of them, and I've taken the 10 things that parents most often run into problems with. And so I'll just slide it over here where it can be seen. This is one of them. This is the format of them. They're two pages. I don't write them all myself. I find them. This is by David McCullough, and it's a value on knowing history and knowing who we are. So, you know, a lot of parents wonder, why are we spending so much time on history and not other things, or don't have enough electives or whatever. These kinds of things help. So it's one of Davey's comments that is certainly something we've had success with.
Just wondering if anybody had done any intentional training with a group of parents, sort of like Dumbledore's Army, to infiltrate and to keep an ear to the parents that are out there. And if you have, how did that work?
We've tried a few different things. We've got a new program going in this year where we've actually dedicated some resources to it. I'll let you know next year.
One thing we did to motivate parents to read was we increased our re-enrollment fee by about $50 to $75. And if they read one or two books, they got that discount back. And they had to just sign an honors thing that they did it. And we actually had one parent read the book, thanked us, wrote us a letter, and then donated to buy books for anyone that wanted them into a library. So that was something that we tried last year. It seemed to work.
Yeah, Ralph, you had told me that before. I'd forgotten that. That is a great one. I love that. Financial incentive. Good old capitalism. Hey, Ty.
Yeah, hey, David. At Veritas, one of the things we did this last year was we had an alumni panel and had our parents come in and sit down with our alums and talk with them. And the parents are always really interested in how does this look at the next level and are you really prepared? And our alumni are probably our most passionate advocates. And they ran into all the problems that parents are feeling, and they worked their way through it. So it was ended up being a good thing.
I had a parent tell me once that the thing that sold them was we told them all kinds of stuff for years. Like 8 years after they started at the school, they came in and visited one of the upper school classes to see whether they thought their kids should go to high school there. And they gushed with, you know, I had no idea education could be like this. So I think that's another factor. We have others back there? Got one forward here, Davies, if you're out of them, right up here.
We like you lose a lot of kids in the secondary to the many times the public schools, they have more programs and whatnot. What does anybody do to perhaps try to put the secondary kids, and particularly 11th graders or 12th graders, kind of up on a stage and show what 12 years of classical Christian education allows them to do? What kind of ideas do people have?
I'll address that because in the outline you'll also see I mentioned video. And we're working on this more than we have been, but we have several short-form videos that we have of class discussions that are available to some of our parents. One of the things is you can cut down on video, you can cut down a discussion that takes an hour into 15, well, actually ours are about 4 minutes, 5 minutes long, and just those sound bites of what the kids are saying, it gets more impactful the shorter you make the video. Now, doing that takes a little bit of resource. You have to be able to, you know, actually technically do it, but that's an effective way.
I would just add to that, to any opportunity you have to publicly engage existing parents or prospective parents, use those upper students, whether it's open houses. We have Heritage Ambassadors, so they are the ones that are actually walking the group through on the tour. They're speaking at open houses. We have, part of our chapel has always been to do recitation, so the older ones are reciting in front of the younger ones, mentoring, reading to the younger. So any way you can do that where parents are seeing the output. And then we have a closing, we have grandparents saying that a closing year-end event called Fine Arts Day, and that is, we actually have a graduation even though we were ending in eighth. And so the young families are looking at the end product, if you will, and buying in at that point. So I'm going to walk over on the side. This side's had no questions, so somebody's got to. Anybody, comments or questions? Okay, great.
We're a new school in a community that largely had never heard of classical education before. And we found a great resource. I'm not sure where I first came across it, but I'm realizing by your school name that y'all publish it. And it's a little magazine that says you'll wish you could go back to school on the front. And it's great for our prospective parents to show the grandparents, show their neighbors, just kind of a bite-sized classical education 101 that's really affordable for us at the school. So I don't know what y'all call that, but that's what I call it.
Yeah, it's called Discover Classical Christian Education, You'll Wish You Could Go Back to School. We developed that out of our school. It's just a little, like, 5-7-page booklet that when we designed it, it was designed, sorry for the crassness here, but it was designed as a bathroom booklet. That's, any page is self-contained in it, so that you learn something about classical education on each page without having to read page to page. So it's available. You can get it through Ambrose.
I would endorse it. We've used it for 5 years, and it's magazine-like, colorful, engaging, easy for a parent to pick up and quickly compare and contrast progressive versus classical education. So yeah.
We did have an interesting experience with it this year, was that for the first time my admissions director, because we've been kind of overwhelmed with applications at our school, praise the Lord, but she started telling them, you need to read this before you come in for your family interview, because if you don't know the booklet, you probably won't get in. It wasn't quite that way, but you know, that's what she said. And I was surprised. All of a sudden, I didn't know she'd done this. And I said, Susan, something's happening. Everybody's coming in with the booklet all marked up. What's going on? So I guess you can apply a little, like Davies said, weight in the front end. Yes.
From the admissions end, to try to encourage families, good quality families, to apply to our school, we wanted to make the financial decision move down the priority list. And so we initiated a try before you buy admissions process, where if you're going to apply for tuition assistance, we waive the application fee. And if you are admitted, we defer the enrollment fee until you have an answer on tuition assistance. And we find that that has increased the quality of applications we receive. And then we immediately put them in touch with families in our community who have miraculous stories to tell about how they've managed to pay tuition for 3, 4, and 5 children.
One of the things we've done at St. Stephen's, we're a church school, was to start a newsletter, and we have a letter from the headmaster, all kinds of things the students are doing, but also articles in there to educate the parents why we do the things we do in the school. And that's been helpful to educate our church community and our school community to appreciate the things that we do. And sometimes we take on the how can you be classical and Christian and things like that that may be an issue to our church as well, and put articles in there.
Yeah, well, that's one of those tough ones. Newsletters, first off, they take a lot of resources to keep going. Secondly, you've got to do them well, or they're just, you might as well throw them away because nobody's going to end up reading them, and you've got to be consistent. And if you've got the resources and somebody who can really do it well, that's a good way to go. But that's been our difficulty with newsletters, is keeping any kind of consistency. That's why I switched over to the headmaster's notes, because it seemed like I could do it on a Sunday night, and people would read it, and they actually could respond to me, which was kind of an interesting thing. I get about 8 or 10 responses a week. So,
Hi, I'm with Providence Classical School in North Houston. And one of the things we do to try to educate potential new families and to spark an interest in classical education in these new families is we have a preschool director's luncheon and we have a realtor's luncheon every fall. And we give them information about our school and they get to know us. And as they work with the families that they're working with, they pass along information. And we do get a lot of referrals and new families from those efforts.
I was going to say we had a similar situation as far as recruiting goes, where we our principal did a luncheon on how to handle difficult parents, and we put it out to the preschool directors in the Atlanta market. There were over 35 preschool directors that showed up, which apparently was a record breaker even for their association on any topic to gather, because it was such a hot topic, and it was just to serve them, but obviously it helped put the name of the school out there in the community, which was great. So, other questions?
Yes, got one right up here.
How much do we compromise with our culture? You know, we recognize that they want bite-sized pieces of information, but we'd love to have a school culture that can take more than 30 seconds, you know? And are we, to a certain extent, we're saying this is where the parents are, we'll do different with the students, but is this going to carry over to the students? Does that question make sense?
I've thought a lot about that, but I mean, you want to kind of take the higher road and say everyone's got to come and read, you know, everything in the original Latin, or else they're not going to be able to engage. But I mean, I think you have to be a realist. I think it's baby steps, and so when we've sent out these coffee and conversation articles, and you get a group of parents that come in that aren't actively reading and they read a small article, then that whets their appetite for then taking it to the next level. So I think it's in some ways, yes, it is compromising, but I think it's necessary to go where they are to pull them through. And same thing with students that come into the school that haven't been in the process, that you have to, you know, build the muscles when they've atrophied in terms of their mind. So, yeah, is there a question? Yeah.
We spend a lot of time talking about educating parents, which is important, but what are the things you use for sizzle to get a person to consider being educated? You know, those things that cause a parent to go, I need to take a new look at this.
Boy, that's a great question. It's true, though. I mean, you've hit on something really hard, but now we're kind of into the marketing as opposed to getting your existing parents on board. I mean, the booklet that she mentioned earlier, it's titled You Wish You Could Go Back to School, because I do hundreds of tours. As a headmaster, I go through, I admit every single family. We've got 470 students, so this has gotten, we do about 100 interviews a year. It's a big job, but I do them all for a variety of reasons. And one of that is what everybody says. Boy, I wish I could go back to school, right? That's the most common thing. So I think the biggest sizzle you've probably got is getting them to see what you're doing. And, you know, we've done a lot of that around our school, what we post on the walls. There have been talks this week on not plastering all kinds of junk all over the walls, but being real deliberate in what you do. It's a big question. It's one bigger than I think I can answer here. But I think that's what you have to do is... I think we all remember back to our public school, many of you in public school at least, grammar school years, where what was your favorite time of the week? Show and tell, because it wasn't math. And everybody likes show and tell. They like to see it, they don't want to hear about it. And that's why we use, you know, we've been using video for a little while with parents, just to show them what's going on in the classroom, because once they see it, I mean, some of these conversations are you know, pretty good. One of them we use, we just took 3 or 4 cameras in. Due to changes in the marketplace, you can find relatively inexpensive videographers. And we shot with 3 cameras a discussion on Milton. And the discussion was the teacher threw out the question about the godly, the particular part of the book that they had read is where Raphael and Adam are talking, and Adam says that Eve is of lesser reason, I think is the word that he uses. And so she throws out this, does this mean women are not as smart as men? And the discussion among the gals was, and the men in the room, the young, I mean, it was immensely deep because it regarded the differences between submission and equality, and, you know, it walked the border. It was not politically incorrect because you don't want to be putting that stuff out there. You got to know your audience. It was right. It was just really well articulated. And those are the kind of things, I gave that specific example because they're the kind of things that people look at and go, I've never seen a teenager talk about this kind of stuff. And they're quoting right out of Milton and saying, no, here, and they're excited about it. And they're arguing back and forth about, you said that, no, I don't think that's what it means. I think this is what it means. And I don't think, you know, and so that's the kind of thing, if you can get somebody to condense those things down into shorts, and you can right now, I mean, use technology. It's maybe, I think we paid about $2,000, which sounds like a lot, for that entire project of filming about three or four classes and getting them edited down into short 5-minute chunks and then throwing them up on YouTube and linking them into our internal families. And we don't do a lot externally with that. We keep it to internal stuff just because right now there's some consequences to, you know, having to get permission from all the parents to get them up there.
I would just add that I think one of the, maybe even call the tragedy of our schools is that parents tend to live through, I call it through their students' backpacks. I mean, they don't have, their touch point to the school is what can you, they unzip the backpack and there's, it's elementary school and there's a bunch of worksheets in there and they think, gosh, this school is just, you know, this tedious worksheet school. All those rich stories, how do you get the story back to the parent? And I think video is definitely a way to do it. We've had a lot of success with the Sizzle bringing graduates in, whether it's at, you know, just anytime, again, if you've got a gathered group, use it as a leverage point. Have a 5-7 minutes, have one of your graduates come in who's off to college and let them talk about the impact of that education on them. And I think parents will look at that and think that is amazing. Video is definitely huge. We have I've seen the one on Heritage about 100 times and I still tear up. We got a great videographer, heritageprep.org. I don't know, I would go to school there even if I didn't have children. It was that kind of inspiring, emotional story. So, yeah.
I think giving parents an opportunity to see the results as often as possible. We tried something new this year at the end of the year, kind of in the midst of re-enrollment, had a living museum, history museum, full day, first through sixth grade, food, camel rides, costumes, the whole thing. And it really caused a lot of conversation among the parents, and then they're bragging on what their kids know, and they can kind of see the results of all those nights of studying those history cards, you know, and it really brought some excitement right at the end of the year, kind of like you said, reminding them again, you know, what we're doing.
Yeah, that's a real good one. We do something called Exordium every 2 weeks, and it's something like an assembly, but the main thrust of it is that the kids get up to two different classes every week, and they do some recitation or some skit or something like that, and get the parents in frequently because they'll come see their kids. We pack the gym out on many days that way, and then they get a flavor for what it really looks like. So that's a really good one, and you've got to do it regularly. It's, if I leave you with one thought in this, it's you're never done. We're in a culture war, not a skirmish. It lasts a long time, and you deal with a lot. You know, you can get parents all on board today, and tomorrow they've forgotten what you're talking about. So you have to keep it out there long term.
One thing we did with video to show the sizzle of the upper school to the grammar school parents to help with retention was, and I sneakily did this, the teacher's actually in the room, the rhetoric teacher, we had him assign a class project to the seniors to do a documentary video on what is a Christian leader. And they did that, and we ended up posting it on YouTube. We actually had a 1-minute teaser that came out the first part of the project about a month before. Then at the end of the school year, the full 7-minute documentary. And it was, what was neat about it was we made the seniors go and interview the grammar school parents and ask them, when they're at the parking lot, what is your view of a Christian leader? And then they did that with students. It's in this documentary, and it even has different people, well-known Christian leaders, talking about what is a Christian leader. And it was very powerful because they got to see firsthand the rhetoric capabilities of the students, and it was also tied to technology, and they really liked that.
Because we kind of moved on this, this wasn't planned, so I'm not sure the audio is going to work here. I'm going to try and play one that we did just similar to what you're talking about. It's not really a documentary. It's just a conversation with students that we play for parents. I don't have audio hooked up, so I'm going to try and do it with the microphone here. If it doesn't work, we'll shut it down. But I'm only doing it because it seems to, conversation seems to have gone this way. I think I can do it with this one.
And it kind of helps you realize that there have been ideas over time, like in the medieval times, there were different ideas from what we have now, and that you need to actually think through and disregard your cultural outlook.
These aren't just dusty old books that we're reading, you know, they're books that have these ideas that are still relevant today. I mean, so many times I find myself sitting in church and my pastor makes a reference to one of the books we've just been reading in class, and I get so excited because I know what he's talking about.
From reading all these old books, you find that nothing is really new under the sun. Something is happening in Iraq, but it's happened before. It's happened in Greece, in ancient Rome, and there's nothing
I think
new.
That the nature of God and things that we as Christians learn from the Bible can also be seen in other books that we read here, like The Consolation of Philosophy by Boethius. We just recently finished reading that. There's a lot in there about God's nature, and as well as nature of evil and fate and providence and all these big questions.
This is my first humanities class in 7th grade. That's where we start that course. And one of the first topics we covered were the worldview questions. I just remember going over that unit, and every day I just felt like I understood the world so much better because I recognized that everyone had these, even if they didn't realize it, they had these assumptions they were making about their entire existence, whether or not there's a God, what is evil in the world, what is good, what is the purpose of man, and those assumptions shaped the way that they acted, and so many people are just completely unaware of that. But as a 7th grader, I was learning that, and so then once you learn that, you don't forget that kind of thing. You start looking at your life in a whole different way.
And so if we can find an ancient Greek book that talks about how somebody felt back then, chances are it's probably a lot like what we're encountering today, just in the more modern
way. One thing that really impacted me as a Christian was reading Sophocles' Antigone, where Antigone is a girl who sacrifices and risks everything to follow what she believes. And there are natural rules in the world that she sacrifices everything to follow this and to write something that is unnatural. And that was just amazing to me, that even in a such a pagan book that was based in a pagan world, that there was something, there was a martyr.
Was when we were reading The Orestes in 7th grade, I realized, even though it's a pagan book, it was so inconsistent. The man was constantly being punished for different reasons, and reasons that were completely different for each human. One of the worldview answers is God is a being infinite, eternal, and unchangeable, but there's so much inconsistency in those other religions.
So every Christian at some point has to ask themselves the question, why am I going to heaven when someone else is not? And how can a just God send some people to hell and some people to heaven? The Great Divorce by C.S. Lewis just really helped me get that straight, where it really just portrays how people send themselves to hell, how in the end, the people in heaven will say we were always in heaven, and the people in hell will say we were always in hell. And it's just amazing. The effect on that had on me was just amazing.
The Divine Comedy.
I'm going to stop it there because I think you get the idea. You notice they aren't wearing uniforms. I had them take those off and put on street clothes. And that's a detail that you have to keep your eye on, because when you're looking at trying to persuade people, sometimes the formality of what we do gets in the way. Our uniforms are very formal, so this was shot with the intention of saying, these are real kids. These aren't some kind of oddballs that you're gonna find in a ivory tower somewhere. These are kids that actually live life, have the same fun that other kids do, at least hopefully in a good way. And so I just wanted to end up with that because it seemed relevant to show you kind of what we had done with that, just asking these guys what classical education had done for them. So I would leave you with that parting comment that a lot of building up your parents. I mean, I fly all the way across the country. I'm a disciple of people who've taught me about classical education. Then I see the young man and the young lady who presented today their speeches, and I think, boy, I wish all my parents could see the output of this education on a regular basis. So this is how we're doing it, because I think truly you can talk about Augustine and his City of God for a lot of time before anybody gets it. But if they just see these kids talking about it, they recognize something great in the works. So I'd like to close out with prayer if we could, so if you bow with me. Lord, I'd pray for each school here. We thank you for your providence, for your continued faithfulness, even when we're not faithful, Lord. And we just pray that you would help your people, both those who understand it and those who don't, knowing that your children are wide and far, that you would bring them all to understand the beauty, truth, and goodness of you, and that that's the essence of what classical education is. And I ask that you would inspire us and help us, and that your Holy Spirit would inspire those families in our schools and each of these schools here to bring about a revival of classical Christian education in America. In Jesus' name, amen. One of them.